Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I often share strategies and ideas, practical protocols that you can use. I tell stories of things that worked, but also those big epic fails that I made along the way, because ultimately I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And today we're going to talk about something that's barely about creativity and teaching, but it's something that's been on my heart for a while. And it's honestly coming from what it is like for me to view social media right now. I see a lot of angry, loud posts on X, which used to be Twitter. And I see a lot of sort of anti-parent, anti-student stuff in the name of comedy on TikTok. And I just am left with this feeling of being unsettled. So even though I typically on this podcast will talk about things like project-based learning or educational technology and AI or student empowerment and ownership, I want to share something different. It's about paradox and nuance, empathy, and the danger in making something a war in education. And before we get started, I want to share one last thing. Check out my new book that's coming out next week or the week after called New Teacher Mindset. It's co-written with my friend Trevor Muir. I'm super excited about it. I'll be sharing more about that next week. But without further ado, here is today's podcast episode. What if we are wrong? I meet up with my friend Tim, whose name I've changed for privacy reasons, who I used to work with when we both taught middle school social studies. We started talking about parenting and uncertainty, and in a more vulnerable moment, he made the following comment. I so badly wanted to be different from my own dad. I wanted to be kind and gentle and approachable. I wanted to be everything he wasn't, but now I sometimes feel like I failed to be some of who he was. Tell me more, was all I could say. Well, I got really into something called gentle parenting, and honestly, I judged you, John, for being a little bit too firm in your boundaries with your own kids. But now, I don't know, I feel like they ended up being more balanced. And I wonder if I need to pull things back a bit. We talk for a while about parenting, and I appreciate his unvarnished honesty and vulnerability. No pretensions, no defensiveness, no, I just need you to affirm for me that I'm still a good dad, and yet that's exactly what I do. Because Tim is a great dad. He's kind and vulnerable and self-aware, and I tell him all of these things. But then we start talking about teaching. And it's here that I ask, okay, being 100% honest, what were we wrong about in education? Tim nods. I think I was wrong about homework. I was gung-ho against it. I thought it stole time from families. But now with teenagers, I kind of like homework. I think of it as sort of a prep for college, and I think it's necessary for my kids. I nod. I was wrong about devices. At the time, they were great. Let's make podcasts. Let's blog. But now I see all the damage of social media, and I'm firmly in the camp of kids shouldn't have phones until high school. Does that make sense? He takes a swig of his IPA and laughs. Dude, you used to write for a blog called Teach Paperless. You remember? I laugh. I really thought that tech could help leverage the creative and connective capacity of learning. And, he says, I was wrong. I just didn't see how much harm social media could do. What if wrong or right isn't the right lens, he asks. I mean, we can all admit that we are fallible human beings in our world trying our hardest to do what's right, but we're broken and the world's broken and we don't have it all figured out. I raise my pint to that. Can we also admit that no one has all the right answers? Can we admit that research is fuzzy and nuanced? Can we agree that there is no instruction manual? He asks. It reminds me of this sketch video I made a few years back, all about this idea that there is no instruction manual in teaching. Nothing is quite as black and white as you think it is. It has me thinking about this. One of my favorite writing prompts I used to use when I taught social studies was create a dystopia, now explain how that utopia has become a dystopia. And if you're interested, you can find it on my YouTube channel. Go to spencervideos.com. You'll find all of my writing prompts, including this particular one. But I think about this often in educational contexts as well. One question I often ask myself is, what are my core values and beliefs about teaching and learning? And then I ask, what does it look if it's taken to an extreme? For example, I believe in self-efficacy. I can see the link between self-efficacy and learning. It's very clear. It's very strong. And yet, the research has shown that there is a shadow side to efficacy. It can lead to small mental errors, to overconfidence, to stagnation in innovation. I believe that learning should be engaging. But the shadow side of it is that if we try to make everything fully engaging, we fail to teach students that sometimes learning is boring, and that's okay. I often write about the need for PBL. I'm a huge fan of project-based learning. I talk about it often on this podcast. You're probably sick of hearing about it. And the research, again, is pretty clear. It leads to improved student outcomes. It makes the learning stickier. And it also teaches these vital SEL skills. And yet, the dark side is that if we all do PBL all the time, we fail to grasp that there are standards that just don't fit with project-based learning. Sometimes students need to do things like phonics and blending and two-step equations, and those don't always fit into something like a project. If we aren't careful, we start to craft authentic PBL that doesn't incorporate any of the structures and scaffolds and supports needed to reduce cognitive load. So truly, there's a dark side to PBL and authenticity. I believe in helping our students become self-directed learners. I talk about this often, right? I wrote a book called Empower. But also, I want my students to learn how to ask for help. I want students to learn how to depend on others in their learning. Yes, I want voice and choice, but I also want students to say, I don't find this relevant now, but I'm going to keep an open mind about it and keep trying. When we ask, how does a utopia become a dystopia? We open ourselves up to some really important guardrails. True, PBL is a great framework, but also we need direct instruction. We need learning supports. We need to be cognizant about cognitive load. When we ask, how does this utopia become a dystopia? We avoid the pitfalls of being a purist in our ideology. And instead, we settle into that beautiful mess that is nuance and paradox and overlap. Ultimately, this nuance keeps us from becoming overly idealistic. We learn to test our core convictions with actual classroom practices. And we land in a space that is ultimately more paradoxical and empathetic and really intellectually humble than a simplistic, purist ideology. The truth is, it's almost always both and. I have this friend, Jen. Now, this is her name. Unlike Tim, she doesn't mind me saying her name. And so there we go. Her name's Jen. And she spent her college days doing improv. Although both she and her wife, Melissa, eventually became math teachers, they fell in love with the dynamic process of saying yes and how it comes out throughout all of improv. Jen teaches eighth graders who are struggling with basic things like linear equations and isolating variables. Melissa teaches AP calculus. They both incorporate elements of building thinking classroom routines. If you're not familiar with that book, it's a great book. And they also do mental math, explicit instruction, and skill practice. Both of these master math teachers have watched the fiery debates between back to basics versus authentic learning, and they don't enter the fray. They step aside and ask, in what context does each approach work best? At one point, Jen said to me, "We talk about this stuff on date nights. Don't you dare judge me, John. That's what we talk about." And we just keep cycling back to the idea that it's not either or. Now, I'm not going to judge them for talking about math instruction on date nights. Okay, I might judge them a little bit, but I think they're onto something here. Nearly all truth in life is nuanced and paradoxical. And I mention this because I have this new book that's coming out. I already talked about it in the intro, called New Teacher Mindset. My friend Trevor Muir and I spent 3 years crafting this bad boy, and I am so excited about it. Our goal was to create the new teacher book that didn't exist when we started out, one centered on student voice and choice and authentic learning. Along the way, I sent a final draft to a friend of mine who said, "I love this. I feel like this was the anti-Harry Wong. This is for the teachers who don't want desks in rows and hours of direct instruction." However, I don't want to be the anti-Harry Wong. I loved first days of school. That book was a lifeline to me when I was brand new. And guess what? It's still a valid book right now. Was it a little more traditional than my taste? Perhaps. Was it more structured than my style? Definitely. But I still have that book with all those annotations I wrote in the margin. I use so many of those ideas within it. And I have no desire to abandon that. My hope instead is that the new teacher mindset might complement it by adding some nuance and some fresh ideas. I want to share those so that teachers can say, "I love first days of school, but I'm going to go a little more student-centered here instead," and they can pick and choose from both approaches. Because truly, it is both and. And I'm reminded that it really comes down to finding those paradoxes in education. I was sitting recently in the airport in Philadelphia, just a couple hours before I left a technology conference. And in the keynote, I talked about the need for vintage innovation. It's the overlap of the tried and true and the never tried. It's the embrace of high-tech and lo-fi tools. It's the notion of embracing technology but centering it on the human experience. I then led 2 workshops on how we can leverage AI for creating scaffolds and supports for students. There are moments when this feels a little bit like cognitive dissonance, and maybe it is. I sometimes wonder where I should plant my flag, right? Is it on the anti-tech or the pro-tech space? Am I a techie or am I a Luddite? I mean, I don't know. But then I'm reminded of Jen and Melissa. It's both and. We absolutely need both approaches. The truth is that nearly every aspect of education is paradoxical. So sitting there in the airport, I made this list of paradoxes. And just bear with me for a second. You'll see what I mean. There's so many. And I want you, as you hear this, to think about what are the other paradoxes that we're missing. Students need to learn how to use their devices wisely and ethically, but also they're not developmentally able to do this, and sometimes we just need to block smartphones from school entirely. That's one idea. We need to follow the science of reading and embrace phonics and blending, but also the science of reading is complicated, and things like prior knowledge, vocabulary, grammatical structures, and language all play a huge role in reading instruction. We need both. Kids will read more if they fall in love with reading, but they can't fall in love with reading if they don't know how to read. Again, we need both. Students should learn content knowledge. Background knowledge is a huge deal. That would be the Edie Hirsch idea. But also, we want students to learn how to think in a particular discipline. So it's actually really important that they learn how to think like mathematicians or historians or economists or writers. And that would be the idea from Bruner. And I would again say, we need both. Student self-direction and ownership is vital for long-term learning, but we also need students to be other-centered and intellectually humble and empathetic. Again, we need both. Assessment should be about mastery of standards, but we also want students to know that things like deadlines and hard work are equally important in the long run. And if we don't assess something, it sends the message that we don't value it. We need lo-fi and high-tech tools. Students need to feel safe, but true psychological safety requires students to wade into discomfort. We need students to focus on both quality and quantity in their creative work. Students need firm boundaries and consequences, but we also need to show them grace and kindness and individualization. Some would look at the list and claim that I'm being wishy-washy. And I might be. I mean, that's a valid criticism. But I'm not advocating for wishy-washy. And I'm not advocating for some kind of moderate middle. I'm not pushing for compromise when compromise isn't necessary. Instead, what I'm saying is that paradox is a recognition that truth is often found in holding two extremes in your arms at the same time and recognizing that these extremes often complement each other if we're open to it. It's forging those two ideas together into a beautiful new synthesis. The key, though, is that we have to recognize the role of context. I've often been on the side of various educational arguments, only to step back and say, well, I'm not sure that's always the case. Consider homework. I'm generally opposed to the practice. But if a student is goofing off during class, I have no problem saying, you wasted time in class. The natural consequence is that you have to take this home and do it at home as homework. Furthermore, I also see value in ramping up some of the homework in high school to prepare students for trade schools and universities and life after school. If our goal is authentic learning, I think it's pretty authentic to say this is what you will experience in the next stage of your life. Or consider worksheets. I used to rail against worksheets, but then in teaching multilingual students, I realized that we just had to do some systematic skill practice worksheets about things like verb tenses and irregular verbs. Of course, our grammar practice was rooted in project-based learning, and we had huge gains through blogging and podcasting and video projects. But the reality is we also did skill practice worksheets with immediate feedback. And I now believe that worksheets and project-based learning can absolutely go hand in hand. So can PBL and direct instruction. When we shift our focus from this strategy is good or bad to when is the best time to use this strategy, we begin to embrace the art of teaching. We step close to empowering teachers by saying, look, we know that you are the expert in your context, and we know that you can choose when to use a particular strategy with your students. I mention this because we are entering a new era of machine learning where we are asking, what can humans do that machines can't do? And for me, a few answers come to mind. Humans are really good at empathy, curiosity, divergent thinking, contextual understanding. Note that none of those are things that AI does well. But also note that those are the exact elements that make teaching an art and a craft rather than some kind of predictable algorithm that you get from superscripted curriculum. As a teacher, you can empathize with a student and say, I think you need blank right now. You can say, I don't understand blank completely, but I will remain curious. You can say, I know my context, I know my students, and right now, what they need is blank. In other words, the nuance is often forged in context and curiosity and empathy. And when that happens, we avoid the dangers of the war metaphor. And so that's my last idea I want to share. 6 months ago, I wrote a blog post about my concerns with treating all reading intervention as if it were an issue of phonics and blending. And I presented this nuanced view of the research relating to reading instruction. I shared the need, for example, to teach verb tenses or to front-load vocabulary. 3 minutes later, and that's all it took, I faced this barrage of comments. People told me I was ignorant. They blasted me for lacking empathy toward dyslexic students. I don't know how that came across. They called me names. They called me more names. They called me names that I'm not going to repeat on this podcast. They told me I shouldn't be a teacher, much less teach other teachers. And one person accused me of educational malpractice and abuse. It was disheartening. And I actually panicked for a while. I took a deep breath and I stepped away from my keyboard. And then I came back and it was even worse. And so I deactivated my X account for 2 whole days. I had gotten caught in the crosshairs of the reading wars. Emphasis on the word war here. According to conceptual metaphor theory, we nearly always identify an underlying metaphor in conversations, and you can see it all the time. When someone talks about a valid and reliable measure in talking about assessment, they are treating assessment and teaching as a science. But when they refer to it as a conversation, they are using a more relational metaphor for teaching. And we see this all the time in conversation when we talk about arguments, right? We will use war metaphors every time something has turned into an argument. It's getting heated. Don't get defensive. Why are you shooting down my argument? You get the idea. And so as we think about reading wars, we see this violent rhetoric all around us. And I actually think that there's a real cost to this. And it's this, because truth is nuanced, it's paradoxical. When we slip into these war metaphors, we create straw man arguments about the opposing side. We treat opponents as enemies. And we treat anyone who disagrees with us as an opponent. We ratchet up the language to the point that well-intentioned educators become the enemy. It's a dark and dangerous process, and I am seeing it all around. And it prevents people from seeing nuance. But more importantly, like all wars, it ultimately leads to casualties. And the greatest casualties aren't just the teachers who burn out, although that's a concern, but also students who become pawns in a form of ideological warfare. I'm not sure there's an easy solution here, but I think it's found in embracing paradox and wonder and nuance and empathy. My hope, and I don't always do this well, is that I want to start from a place of nuance and curiosity and ultimately recognize that teaching is often messy and muddled and imperfect. And that's the beauty of what we do. Our students don't need perfection. They need us. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a review on Apple Podcasts, which I think used to be iTunes, and Spotify or Amazon Music or Google, whatever it's on there. Just wherever you find it, can you leave a review? That would be awesome. And also don't forget to subscribe. The other thing I'll say is this, one of the best ways for spreading the word about this podcast is to just tell a colleague about it. So telling a friend would be a huge thing as well. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.